98 years ago, on January the 5th, 1914, there was an announcement in front of this factory. And as a result of the announcement, they needed to have police protection, and the Wall Street Journal had scathing reviews. They predicted that this company would go bankrupt and that everything would fall apart. On January 5th, 1914, Henry Ford announced that employees henceforth would make a minimum of $5 a day. Up until that point in Detroit, a skilled machinist's wage was at max $2.50 a day. And everybody from the lowest of the assembly line workers all the way through could count on making at least $5 in a day. We look at that and we say, times have changed. The dollar doesn't buy what it used to buy. As we look at the book of Ruth, we're going to see someone by the name of Boaz who is going to manifest a level of grace to a woman by the name of Ruth that is far beyond what anyone ever would have expected. And we're going to see the Lord's hand at work in this passage. And we are going to see how the Lord is going to draw things together for a pair of widows, Ruth and Naomi, for whom it looked like life was coming to a bitter and very anticlimactic end after the deaths of their husbands. Let's review what we covered last week in the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth occurs during the time of the judges. Now, there's a refrain that shows up many times in the book of Judges, and you're going to hear it many times today. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Each man was his own God, and they weren't very interested in following what the Lord had to say. The book of Ruth takes place during that period of time. During this particular period of time, when Ruth is going on in Judah, there was a lot of trouble from a neighboring tribe called the Midianites, and they would come in and they would steal crops as they were ready to harvest. And as we saw last week, the people resorted to living in caves and dens, and Elimelech decided it was time to get out of here. And he went away to Moab and stayed there for a long time. In fact, during the 10 years of being there, both he died and his two sons died as well. However, we saw one very bright spot, and that bright spot was Naomi. She had ministered to her two daughters-in-law, and they became believers. We see evidence of that within Ruth chapter 1. And both Orpah and Ruth wanted to return with Naomi to Judah when Naomi announced plans to do so. She had heard that the Lord had provided bread for his people, and in particular, because Gideon had arisen to power as a judge, the area of Judah was somewhat more under control at this point. Naomi, who wished now, instead of being called Pleasant, to be called Mara, that is, bitter, because of the bitterness that she saw the Lord having brought into her life, where she blamed him. She told Orpah, and she was trying to convince Ruth, stay here. You need to get married. Don't come with me. You'll be a foreigner. You're going to be a poor person. You can be much happier if you stay here in Moab and remarry. But Ruth chose God and Naomi over family, and security. That brings us to Ruth chapter 2. So let's consider verse 1. There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, or it would be better understood, of great moral worth or moral character, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. In verse 3, we're going to see the evidence, actually, that this should be translated as of great moral character or great moral worth. But what we see here, and we'll go into more detail when we get into chapter 4 of this, I see Elimelech as having been the eldest of three brothers. Then there's a certain so-and-so. He's never given a name within the book. We have no clue what his real name was, but he's called Poloniel Moni, a certain so-and-so. And it's a really humorous passage when we see how that was set up. The author had a sense of humor. But the third son is Boaz. In chapter 4, we're going to see evidence that he's actually the third of three. It's in verse 3 of chapter 4 that Boaz is speaking to Poloniel Moni, and he says, "Our brother Elimelech." So this is where we find the definition of what type of close relation he is. And we find in a couple of passages here that Boaz is the second closest kinsman who would be able to redeem Ruth. The one who's actually closer is Poloniel Moni. But when we say that there's one worthy brother, there was one unworthy brother. Now in verse 2, Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So Ruth plans to glean, and what she does is she asks Naomi for permission to ask a farmer for permission. And Naomi agrees. In verse 3, we're told that she happened upon Boaz's field. And this is actually a slightly humorous statement, as we'll soon find out. Let's read verse 3. "Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech." Now, this "happened to" is really funny. I mean, it's really hilarious. My parents always said that if we were traveling, that if you saw a truck stop and there weren't very many vehicles around, you probably didn't want the food there. But if you saw it really crowded with all sorts of people, then you knew that it was good food. As those truckers go back and forth and they know that this is a place they can get good food. Well, let's look at the fields of Poloniel Moni. You'll notice that his fields here, I'm showing them as exactly double the size of Boaz's. And there's a simple reason. Since Elimelech has died, he's now the eldest son, and he has the double portion. So he has a lot of land, and Boaz has half as much. Notice this helps us to see something about verse 1. In verse 1, it was given the translation, he was a man of great wealth. Well, actually, there's someone of far greater wealth. And that someone else of far greater wealth is Poloniel Moni. And we're going to find in chapter 4 when we get there, and I'm trying to whet your appetite, we're going to find that Poloniel Moni was a real money grubber. And he was really worried about certain things, and that's why he didn't want to cooperate with Boaz's proposal. But notice here that we have "do not trespass" signs on Poloniel Moni's fields. Now, what we're depicting with sort of the brown background on that is that this field has been reaped. But now as you look at Boaz's field, not only does he have less, but what has he left? He's left the corners for poor people to come in. Now, how do you think that Ruth happened upon Boaz's field? She sees the people walking, and where are they going? They're not going to Polony Almoni's field. He's got guard dogs. He's got people out there with Uzis. He's got everybody protecting his field so that nobody comes in and takes away any of his barley. But what we have at Boaz's field is a welcome mat. Now, let's take a look at the excerpts that I have here from Leviticus chapter 19. You shall not wholly reap the corners. Now, nobody has figured out how big the corners were. We have no idea. You shall not wholly reap the corners, nor gather the gleanings. So if you're cutting and it falls on the ground, you leave it on the ground. And if you have grapes, do not gather every grape of your vineyard. Leave them for the poor and the stranger. But Polony Almoni was doing what was right in his own eyes. That's what everyone was doing in the period of the judges. But Boaz is a man of great character. And even though he has a smaller field, he's leaving the corners. And we see evidence that Ruth is not the only person that has come in to glean. The way she happened upon the field, she followed the line of people going to his field. Now in verse 4, we have Boaz coming from the town of Bethlehem. And he comes out and he greets his workers in the Lord, and they return the greeting. In verse 4, and behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered him, "The Lord bless you." Now you hear people saying, "Lord bless you." And say, did they mean that? But with Boaz, it becomes very clear that he meant it. And he's a man who is very much seeking to please the Lord and is interested in the Lord's working in the lives of those with whom he has contact. The Lord who is in charge, he is asking to bless these who are helping him. Now in verses 5 and 6, he happens to notice that there's someone new that he's never met that's out in the field gleaning. After all, Bethlehem is not a large town. And so here they are out in the fields outside of the town, and he notices there is someone here that I'm not familiar with. So he spoke to his foreman, and in verses 5 and 6, Boaz said to his servant, who is in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this? Whose wife is this?" So the servant who is in charge of the reapers answered and said, "It is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab," or from the fields of Moab. And so he's interested in who is this, and so he asks his foreman, and he receives an update. Now in verse 7, he gets a further report from the foreman. He says that she is both respectful and diligent. Verse 7. Ruth said, that is, she said to the foreman, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house. We saw earlier in the passage, she approached Naomi and said, "I would like to go out and glean in someone's field who will let me." She asked for permission from Naomi, and she furthermore asked permission from the foreman. But besides that, besides asking please, she says thank you in the sense that she's very diligent about her work, and the foreman is noticing that she is working very diligently in order to glean. At this point, Boaz speaks with Ruth, and he offers her shelter, offers her protection. We've seen that within this period of time, there is difficulty with the Midianites. And they still are a problem, although they are not quite as rampant as they had been earlier. Furthermore, Polonia-Lemoni doesn't seem to be the most noble of characters, and then there are other people running around that Boaz is wanting to make sure that she is protected from them. After all, this is the period of the judges, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. So Boaz says, be careful. Verse 8, then Boaz said to Ruth, you will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. What Boaz is saying is, I know that you might be thinking, well, I've got to go out into some other fields and glean in order that there's going to be enough food, because after all, pretty soon the barley harvest will be over, and then the wheat harvest will come in about a month, and then it'll be over, and then what are we going to eat? So what Boaz is saying is, just stay here. Don't worry about going elsewhere. Don't put yourself in harm's way. Leave this in the Lord's hands. Accept my protection. And in verse 10, we see that Ruth is very grateful. She expresses how, even though she's a foreigner, that this man is extending grace to her. And that's a picture of Ellis Island. Verse 10, so she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor or grace in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? She said, you know, you're treating me better than people even in Moab treated fellow Moabites. How is it that you are being so gracious to me? In verse 11, Boaz explains, he knows what she has given up, and he knows how devoted she is to taking care of her mother-in-law, Naomi. In verse 11, Boaz answered and said to her, it has been fully reported to me. After all, he's a close relative. It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and have come to a people whom you did not know before. He said, what you have done is noteworthy. And I am wanting to provide for you. That's at the human level. But, you know, it's a very difficult thing for people to leave somewhere behind that they've been their whole life. And it's really hard to burn the bridges in the sense of saying, I'm not going back. This new place is going to be my home. Now, I'd like for you to see friends that we have ministered with in Montana. They are former Hutterites. I don't know if you're familiar with Hutterite communities. But Hutterite communities, people live isolated, highly legalistic. The pastors don't preach. They're only allowed to read 400-year-old sermons. And that's the extent of church. People are not encouraged to read their Bibles. They have a German dialect that makes it so that their English is quite distinctive, making it hard for them to blend in if they leave the colonies. They're isolated, and then there are always eyes and ears watching to see if anyone is doing anything subversive. The man to the left was the spiritual leader for a community of 120 people. And because of the other people in this picture, they were ministering there to the people in one of the nearby Hutterite communities. He became a believer, and his wife as well. This is a cradle-to-grave security system. People didn't even own a pencil. And they were excommunicated in their 60s because they were believers. Zero financial security. There have been about 70 people that have left the communities within the last 6 or 7 years, and our friends are ministering with the Gospel of John to about 30 of them. This is in the United States. Let's look at the next slide. Here's a Hutterite community, and you notice men and women are segregated even for meals. Families do not eat meals with families. They eat them communally. They're only allowed 15 minutes for the meal because anything longer than that is worldly. But you have security. And we see people who are coming to the Lord, becoming believers, and becoming vocal about the Lord. This is one of the things that the Gospel of John is doing as people minister with a book designed to clarify the message of grace. Just think how hard it was for Ruth to leave her homeland, to leave her family, to leave everything she knew, to go to a place where she's going to be a foreigner, and she's a widow, speaks with an accent, and would not expect to be accepted. And she's looking at Boaz and she's saying, I never dreamed that someone would be so gracious to me as you are being gracious to me. Can you imagine how her heart was lifted? Can you imagine what it was that she was fearing her life was going to be like? And now she is seeing grace being bestowed upon her. But Boaz, in verse 13, will help us to understand what he's thinking a little further. He's not just thinking at the horizontal plane. Boaz is a man who is very much concerned about the way that the Lord operates with people. And so what he says is, may the Lord reward you. And we need to make a careful distinction. Reward is earned. It's not a gift. When you go out and work and someone gives you a paycheck, if they said, here's your gift, that's not a gift, is it? You worked for it. You earned it. Rewards are looking at God-honoring faithfulness. And he's speaking about reward here in verse 13. Verse 12. The Lord repay your work. And a full reward be given to you by the Lord, God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. Boaz is saying here, I'm not the ultimate source of the grace. The ultimate source of the grace is God, and may he reward you because he's in a far better position to reward your faithfulness as a faithful believer than I will ever be able to do. Now it comes to mealtime. And so, in verse 13, she's welcomed without stigma. And she said, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. I'm not of the same ethnicity. I'm from a different country. And I greatly appreciate your grace. Now, I would like to make note of something here that's a little bit of background that we might not think of here. She's welcomed without stigma, but interestingly enough, there's quite a bit of stigma already in Boaz's family. Boaz is in the lineage of David and in the lineage of Jesus Christ, in the lineage of those who would be kings. And yet, he has an ancestor, Tamar. And in Genesis chapter 38, we see a levirate marriage, and she had to trick her father-in-law so that she could have a son. And then we have Boaz's mother is identified for us in Matthew, and she's Rahab, the harlot, a Gentile, a Canaanite who believed. And then later on, we're going to have Solomon's mother is Bathsheba, and you know about her. And then, although there's no moral taint on Mary, Jesus' mother, lots of people thought that there was something illegitimate there because she had a child by a virgin birth. All of this is very much in keeping with the fact that God told to Abraham in Genesis 12:3, "In you, in your lineage, shall all families of the earth be blessed." And he's looking forward to the blessing that would come through Jesus Christ. So now let's get to the mealtime in verse 14. In verse 14, now Boaz said to her at mealtime, "Come here and eat the bread, and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed parched grain to her, and she ate and was satisfied. There was more than enough food given to her. And she kept some back. We'll find out what she has in mind for that a little later. Now, my mother liked to tell about when they would go over and visit relatives of my father's in Middle River, Minnesota. And they'd get up early in the morning, and I'm sure since a number of people here are from out in the eastern plains of Colorado and we're out on the grain farms, I'm sure you can identify with this, and you can probably tell a story better than I can on this one. But my mother would say they would go, and they'd be up dark and early and be preparing a major meal, and then as soon as they got the dishes washed, they were preparing the next meal, and then as soon as the dishes were washed, they prepared the next meal, and they kept doing that all the way through the harvest. And notice this foreigner, not even an employee, someone who, shall we say, an independent contractor, is out there in the field and is invited to come in and partake of a meal and is given enough that she not only is satisfied, but she's able to store up some besides. Now in verses 15 and 16, now it's time for new work rules to be imposed on Boaz's laborers. So he has a little pep talk and tells them how they are supposed to function. Verses 15 and 16. "And when she rose up to glean," so she's gone back into the field, now he has a little talk. "He commanded the young men, saying, 'Let her glean even among the sheaves.'" So when you've gathered together the sheaves, let her even take those. She doesn't have to just pick up the little pieces off the ground. "And do not reproach her. Also, let grain from the bundles fall purposefully for her. Leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her." He's going above and beyond the call of duty. This is like Henry Ford saying, every worker is going to get $5 a day. Although Boaz is even more gracious than that. So then in verse 17, it says that she gleaned in the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. So over 30 pounds. That's way beyond what one could ever expect to find picking up individual stalks that had fallen down onto the ground. She's coming away with a huge amount of food. And it's 30 pounds of threshed grain, not 30 pounds of the whole works. And notice, she works until evening, and then after it's turned dark, then she's there beating it out, and then she would be throwing it up in the air in order that the chaff would blow away. And so then, in verse 18, she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. So she brought out and gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied. So she had leftovers from lunch. She said, here's lunch, and then here's this bushel of threshed grain. Clearly, Boaz is not doing what's right in his own eyes. Boaz is doing what's right in the Lord's eyes. But this raises a question for Naomi. And we saw that Naomi had become very discouraged. Naomi is past childbearing age, and she thought that the levirate marriage was going to happen through her and that she was going to have to bear a child in order to preserve the inheritance for her deceased husband, Elimelech. But the gears start turning. And this very evening, Naomi starts to figure out that, hey, wait a moment. God can work through Ruth. It doesn't require me. And she's saying, okay, who was it that took note of you? And she's wanting to make sure it's the right person that was wanting to take note of her and not the wrong person. She doesn't want to get her hopes up if it turns out it was Poloni Almoni. Instead, she's soon going to find out that it's Boaz. But the author, as we read this passage, holds back that information. He waits until the last possible moment to say that it's Boaz, that you're saying, who is it? Who is it? And you're wondering, clear up until the last moment. So let's look at verse 19. And her mother-in-law said to her, where have you gleaned today? And where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. Got to hold this off until the very last moment. And can't you imagine Naomi saying, what a relief. Naomi is looking at this massive amount of grain, and she says, I know that you didn't get this just gleaning. Someone was looking out for you, and that someone was Boaz. And Naomi is suddenly looking at life from an entirely different perspective because she can see that the Lord is taking care of them. The Lord is faithful to his covenant. So now we get to verse 20. And she prays for blessing, covenant blessing for Boaz. In verse 20, then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Lord who has not forsaken his chesed, his kindness, his covenantal loyalty to the living and to the dead. And Naomi said to her, this man is a relative of ours, one of our close relatives. Of course, Naomi's thinking, but he's not quite the closest one. But I think Naomi is starting to see maybe the Lord can work even around that. We are starting to see Naomi from the way she had been earlier in her life, when she was able to minister to Orpah and to Ruth. Because she is seeing that the Lord's hand is good whereas she's been seeing it as the Lord is pushing her away, the Lord is bitter towards her. Please notice in the translation that the word his in front of kindness is capitalized. What she's saying is, blessed be Boaz of the Lord, who has not forsaken the Lord's chesed. That's where we got the title of this message, because it's ultimately the Lord's covenantal loyalty. It's not that Boaz is so great. It is that Boaz is learning from a great God. And Boaz has learned that it's wise not to be doing what's right in his own eyes, but to be doing what is right in the Lord's eyes. Verse 21 and 22. Ruth mentions that Boaz had urged her to accept his protection, and Naomi concurs. Ruth the Moabitess said, "He also said to me, 'You stay close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest, both the barley harvest and the wheat harvest that will come a month later.' And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, 'It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, and that people do not meet you in any other field.'" Accept his protection. He is indeed a man of worthy character. He's not doing what's right in his own eyes. He's doing what's right in the Lord's eyes. So accept his protection. So then, in verse 23, we have 1 month's security. At this point, Ruth figures, well, I have security now. I can get barley now, and then I can get wheat later, but what comes after that? So notice as it reads, "So she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of the barley harvest and wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law." What it's saying is she was fixing to glean all the way through both harvests. But the Lord has other plans, and we're going to find in chapter 3 and chapter 4 that things are going to come to a conclusion much more quickly. A lot of people, when they have looked at chapter 3, have wondered if something improper happened. It did not. And wait until you see the evidence next week. This book is full of the evidence that everything was done on the up and up. When we think about Henry Ford and how he said every worker is going to get $5 a day, and 12 years later he announced, "From now on we're going to pay people 6 days' wages for 5 days' work." That's where the 8-hour day and the 5-day work week originated, with Henry Ford in 1926. But look at Boaz. Boaz wasn't operating according to some utopian theory like Henry Ford. Boaz knew what the Word of God said. And Boaz, as a believer, wanted to please the Lord and do what was right in his eyes. We also ought to desire the same thing. As we live our lives, others should be touched by the grace that they hear from us reflecting what God has said in His Word, and as we live in accordance with His Word. When we look at this book, we look at the book of Ruth. What kind of situation would Ruth and Naomi be in if they had not come under God's protection? by people who were following the word. And if it had not been for the ministry that Naomi had had when Ruth came as a Moabitess, undoubtedly as an unbeliever, who would have ministered to Naomi in her time of need? God works through his word, but we need to look for the opportunities to share his word, and we need to look for the opportunities to apply his word and leave the results in God's hands. Let's pray.